Hey everyone, right now teachers are getting ready for the end of school, but of course throughout the school year, many teachers go through various opportunities for professional development. Now, it doesn't take many teachers when you talk to them for them to give conflicted views on how effective their professional development opportunities actually are. What happens if a district is actually more intentional, not only about providing those opportunities, but actually planning how those opportunities are presented to teachers to achieve maximum effectiveness? That's the topic we'll be discussing on today's Teaching Matters.
Welcome to Teaching Matters, a podcast exploring all things teaching and learning. Teaching Matters is produced by NPR affiliate WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio. And here is your host, Dr. Scott Titsworth, Dean of the Scripps College of Communication at Ohio University.
Thanks so much, Trinity. Joining me today is my guest, Jim Hall, who is the CEO of the K-12 Coalition, an organization focused on bringing grounded and applicable solutions to the professional development initiatives in K-12 schools. Jim has served as a classroom teacher in addition to leading an organization in Washington, D.C. that helps schools arrange trips to the nation's capital. And Jim, I want to talk to you about that as part of this. But I first just want to welcome you to the podcast. Thanks for giving me your time today.
Scott, well, I'm excited to talk about that. My previous experience, my teaching experience, and my current organization. And thank you so much for having me on your show today.
Absolutely. So I guess I want to start, you know, with the premise. And as I mentioned before the podcast began, my daughter is currently a teacher and goes through these professional development experiences. And you know, in higher education, where I'm at, we obviously have these sorts of things at universities. But I kind of want to take a bigger picture or 10,000 foot view, if you will, and have you talk about why it is that districts want to provide professional development in general. How does it help the district? And then also, there are reasons why individual teachers might want to get professional development. Can you kind of talk about that landscape to set the stage for why this is such an important topic?
So, you know, districts and states and individual schools and building principals, I mean, they have a variety of reasons for why they want their teachers to take professional development. Some of it is simple compliance issues, you know, around health safety issues. Some of it is around, you know, changing practices, changing beliefs, like, you know, the whole science of reading going from whole language to balance to science of reading, that has changed so dramatically in the last 20 years. And so teachers need to get trained on new thinking, new ideas, you know, how to be the most effective in the classroom. I mean, it's all intended to drive student outcomes, broadly measured student outcomes. And there's so many new things that have come up in the last few years, especially since the pandemic and social emotional learning issues and trauma-informed issues and so many more multi-language learners in schools. And there's, of course, turnover. There was kind of an acceleration of turnover during COVID and right after that. And so there are a lot of new teachers in the classroom. And so continuing education and professional development, just like any profession, is just super important. I mean, you want to go to a doctor that's up to date on all the latest science. And if you're going to the lawyer to get, you know, will drafted or your taxes done or something, is you want teacher or a lawyer who's, you know, really well informed. And the same thing for the teacher. Is if your children are going to school, you want your teachers of them to be really, really well informed. So I think there's just a whole bunch of reasons why continuing education and professional development of teachers is so, so important to outcomes for children. Mm-hmm. And we've seen now over the last several cycles of the NAEP scores is that there are real challenges out there, and that trend started before COVID. But then it accelerated, and it hasn't really turned around yet. And maybe it's flattening out right now, but we need to get it back where it was, if not, you know, several points higher than where it was kind of in 2017 or 15 when it hit its peak.
So, you know, based on what you said, obviously there's a lot of problems that districts and principals and teachers might want to solve by going through professional development training. Put on a different hat, and I'm sure you interact with a lot of administrators at the building and district level. When they're thinking about sort of the professional development opportunities that they present to their faculty and their staff, what does that typically look like? I mean, I know that, you know, they're facing budget challenges. They face time challenges for the teachers. They want to present something, but they also, you know, have a lot of realities that face them. So what does that decision-making process look like when it actually, you know, hits the street?
Yeah, I mean, I think a little bit depends on what they're trying to train on. I do think too much professional development is kind of, you know, getting all the teachers into the cafeteria or the teacher's lounge and someone talks for, you know, a couple of hours and it's, you know, kind of sit and listen. And there are probably, you know, half a dozen teachers at the front that are pretty engaged and a few in the middle that are kind of sneaking looks at their cell phone and some in the back that are probably not paying much attention at all. And, you know, to me, you know, that kind of professional development is just not that effective. That you need to get much farther up on the learning scale for learning to be effective. I mean, it requires writing, it requires application, it requires reflection, it requires refinement, it requires kind of modification depending on the children, depending on the teacher. And so to me, you kind of get way up higher into the learning scale to get really, truly effective continuing education, professional development. And we kind of split them into two buckets of continuing education and professional development and define them a little differently. And I don't think there's common language across all of education of which is which, but we do put them into two, you know, kind of different buckets. And then professional development, you know, for us, it's like having instructional coaches in the classroom, which we do a fair amount of that type of work. And, you know, a lot of, you know, My student teaching experience is the evaluator sat in the back, made a whole bunch of notes, and kind of, you know, at the end of the class, broke me aside and we had our meeting and told me what I did right, told me what I did wrong. I said, did I really do that? And, you know, a little bit of a, not quite sure. And so, you know, our thinking actually on in-classroom instructional coaching is you give feedback in the moment and you do it in a polite and effective way, but where you're helping the teacher kind of in the moment with the with the students and who might be struggling a little bit. But, you know, that to me is like really effective instructional coaching is kind of in the moment instructional coaching.
Right, right. And just to tie back on a nuance that you brought up about continuing education, am I correct in assuming that that would oftentimes be where teachers are trying to accelerate their or enhance their credentials for salary reasons or promotion reasons, et cetera?
Exactly. So we define continuing education as what we offer are 3-credit-hour graduate level continuing education courses. They should take about 45 hours for the teacher to complete the coursework. They should require additional work in the classroom of application, synthesis, reflection. But those are what we call graduate level continuing education courses. And teachers take them for a variety of reasons. One, they may have a very particular need in their classroom, and I want to take this course because I really need to know this subject matter. It could be many states require these types of courses for license renewal, and it could be, like you said, their career progression. So it could be salary advancement. Many contracts with teachers, their salary is determined by their educational attainment. And if they have a bachelor's degree plus, you know, 15 credit hours, they move up in the scale. If they get to a master's degree, all the way up to if they get a doctoral degree, is kind of where they would kind of max out on their salary schedule.
Yeah. And I noticed on the Coalition's website that you do these courses, the continuing education courses, oftentimes, if not exclusively, in partnership with universities. Is that correct?
That is correct. We have about a half a dozen partner universities. We write the courses using our professional learning model and then submit them to the universities where their faculty review them, but we write them. We provide the course instructors on them, and we provide the course evaluation on them. But they are in partnership with about a half a dozen universities that we work with.
Yeah, very good. When I was reviewing your organization, obviously there's a heavy emphasis on using different types of, you know, evidence-based solutions. Excuse me. And things like that as you're putting together your professional development, I'm sure your courses. Inside that is an idea of what obviously you think results in effective professional development that is more than just a checkbox of, you know, we brought the teachers in, put them in a seminar for a few hours, and then said we did it. How do you sort of, you know, in your mind as the leader of this organization, delineate between sort of the just get it done because we have to versus how do we do it in a way that has high impact?
Right. So, you know, late in life, I went back and got a master's degree in education. You know, I saw there what kind of good coursework looks like, and it does dig way deep into deeper thinking. Mm-hmm. And that's how we think about our coursework and the courses that I took. I would say that, you know, thinking about a professional learning model is, you know, kind of starting with maybe a reading, and then you come in and the you know, the professor is giving you kind of some direct instruction, and then may break into a class discussion, maybe followed up by a video of a teacher in a classroom with further discussion around those techniques and topics, and then it probably turns into a writing exercise, and then it may turn into creating a lesson plan, teaching a model lesson, coming in kind of, you know, the next day or the next class cycle. And so to me, I think about kind of a wheel of learning in the cycle, in a professional learning model. And if you think about Bloom's revised taxonomy, it kind of starts there at the bottom, which is kind of, you know, just a little bit of knowledge and then some synthesis. And then, you know, you get into the application analysis, evaluation and creation. And to me, that's kind of what a true adult learning model should look like. And we have kind of our own adult learning model here that's, I would say, very similarly related to Bloom's, mm-hmm. you know, revised taxonomy. And so, you know, it's, you know, engaging with knowledge, maybe activating some prior knowledge, which Piaget, you know, always talks about is, you know, tying it back to something the teacher has always done. You know, in inquiry, reading, you know, research-based articles that tie into the science of learning or the science of reading, or what I think is going to be next is the science of mathematics or numeracy. and then synthesizing that, integrating it into your classroom, testing it in your classroom, you know, activating it with kids, and then, you know, coming back and revising it is, all right, this worked for me, but I want to tweak it a little bit. And you've got this huge laboratory in your if you're a teacher, you've got all these kids and you can try things. But it worked for me, but it might not work for the next teacher and I might need to modify it. Or it worked for 70% of my kids, but I need to tweak it for these other kids. And so to me, that's what real learning is. It's kind of a virtuous cycle. And I do think if you've mastered that a couple of times, you can also like synthesize it into other areas or other things that you're doing. Kind of that whole learning circle or cycle or, you know, the pyramid in Bloom's taxonomy.
I really like the way that you talk about that in a way that really emphasizes the application of what it is that's being learned. I think
that's right.
You know, unfortunately, there's a lot of classes that students take and professional development opportunities. They don't really ever achieve that level. And it's nice to hear you really wanting to emphasize that so that teachers come out of it with something that, you know, hopefully improves the experience that they have as a professional, in addition, obviously, to their students.
Right.
You mentioned this, the science of reading. I've had, I don't know, over the course of just this season, probably 4 to 5 guests on the podcast talking about the science of reading from different vantage points.
Yeah.
What led to you and your organization emphasizing that? And what is the approach that you take in sort of helping teachers understand the science of reading and how to implement that body of work into their instruction?
Yeah, so my deep expertise is on the social sciences and particularly mm-hmm. on economics, and so I'm superficial on science of reading.
Yeah.
But we have a very broad offering on continuing education. We did feel like science of reading was a little bit of a weakness in our offering. We had some in our continuing education courses, and so we brought on Keys to Literacy last year with Joan Sedita, who is the founder of that organization, who is one of the foremost minds in the science of reading, and deep expertise. She's written 13 books on it, and her most recent book is around adolescent literacy, which in my opinion is the next phase of science of reading. Is we've done an okay job, and some states have done better than others, of kind of really thinking about elementary mm-hmm. science of reading, but it's often stopping at fifth grade, and even Mississippi, that is credited with their miracle or their marathon or whatever you want to call it, is their test scores at eighth grade and in high school are plateauing. They're flattening out a little bit. And so I think even they are starting to think about what do we need to do with secondary students in adolescent literacy to kind of continue the process there. And I have some, you know, interesting thoughts on that. As you know, and I'm just a huge proponent of writing. That is just so, so important to the learning process and synthesizing things that you have read about. And, you know, that I think is the next phase of science of reading. And we actually are just getting ready to launch a project in combination with the state of Indiana on adolescent literacy. And we're going to develop their coursework to train their teachers on that. And, you know, I think there's this some thinking that, you know, in early elementary, you're learning to read. And then kind of by the time you get to late elementary and into, you know, secondary school is you're reading to learn. I don't really agree with that. To me, you are reading to learn in kindergarten and you are still learning to read even in college, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, as a personal example, I mentioned I went back and got a, you know, master's degree late in life. And I'm a pretty good reader. I don't know how many pages per minute I read on a novel, but you know, I can blow through one on a, you know, weekend at the beach and you probably have, you know, whatever, 95% comprehension. And when I got back into my master's program is I'm suddenly reading academic, you know, peer reviewed articles, and I've got to rethink and relearn how to read that kind of an article. And it's a very, very different experience. And if I were to read a 15 page academic article in 30 minutes, I probably remember the abstract, and that's about it on it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so to me, it goes back to, all right, you know, I got to remember like Cornell note-taking and underlining things and kind of stopping and pausing at the graphs and kind of really understanding that. And so then when you think about like, you know, I taught AP macroeconomics briefly, and those kids, you know, they're getting exposed to academic language in that course. And you know, and I was also in a school where I think there were 90 different languages that were taken in that school. And so while a student might appear to be fluent in English, and they are certainly in a conversational setting, and so you're talking about their, you know, after school activities or what they did over the weekend, and you don't know, they speak without an accent, even though their first language might have been something else, is they don't have that academic language. And you really need to think about that. And so we have to continue to teach reading all the way through. And you may even see this in your university students of having to teach how to read something when you get to that. And, you know, I mean, I, you know, one of the lessons was on the Federal Reserve Bank, and we're talking about the Open Market Committee on the Federal Reserve. It's like, what the heck is this stuff? And so you have to stop and think that these kids don't have the same background, and they really do need to kind of pause and think deeply about reading and kind of at every stage of the academics. And the other thing that I think is just so, so important when you get into that is writing. Is I think it's an often overlooked. And if you want to get up into the higher levels of Bloom's taxonomy, you have to write. You have to write. And, you know, I made my AP Econ students write, and they were, you know, I signed up for this course. I didn't think I was going to have to write. And no, you have to write. And it just really forces them to think about the arguments. Mm-hmm. And to put them down on paper and to get them right. And I think that just so, so deepens the learning experience.
So your comments are so on target and insightful. You are correct that by the time the students get into my classrooms, obviously they've been admitted to universities. And so there is a high level of literacy technically. And you are absolutely correct that when they start reading even, you know, textbooks for 100/1,000 level classes that are, you know, by and large written for grade levels below college, they struggle getting through those. Mm-hmm. And you're also correct that as they start to delve into more technical literature, where the vocabulary becomes more professional, it is difficult for them. And the reaction, if you talk to publishing companies like McGraw-Hill or active classroom teachers, the reaction of the students is they just don't read it. And so you're right. I think that, you know, you can teach base level reading skills at the elementary level, but if you do not continue cultivating growth in that area, it makes it more and more and more challenging as the material that you have to consume gets more and more difficult. And so I think you're, and I also think your insight about the science of math instruction and numeracy, following this on, I think you're very much on point with that. So those two topics, math and reading, obviously you've articulated well. Based upon other patterns that you've seen, from either individual teachers seeking out continuing education and or districts bringing you in to consult on mm-hmm. professional development. What are the other big topics that, especially the more forward-thinking districts, mm-hmm. are really trying to elevate and focus on to bring their staff up to where they want them to be?
I mean, obviously, the hot topic of the day is AI, artificial mm-hmm. intelligence, and what are the appropriate uses for teachers? What are the appropriate uses for students? How do you make sure learning is happening? How do you make sure students are turning in their own work? I mean, those are topics that we try to provide frameworks for schools and students or teachers to make, mm-hmm. their decisions without kind of weighing in too heavily on it, because I think different people are going to take different approaches to it. I mean, I've got some thoughts on, where it should be used. But that I would say is, I think we've written 9 continuing education courses on artificial intelligence in the last 2.5 years. And so that yeah. clearly is one of the big emerging topics. And then, of course, you touched on it and I touched on it is mathematics. Mm-hmm. That is an area where we are failing many students in this country, is not giving them a solid background in math when they get into school or into upper elementary mm-hmm. And beyond.
Yeah, one of the things. So I've had several guests on that sort of come out of the ed tech sector, and mm-hmm. in one way or another, obviously they're trying to emphasize the utilization of AI through their tools and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I always ask the question, I know that you're not saying that AI is replacing instruction. So what does education look like once these tools yeah. are used more often, especially from the teaching side of the classroom? And their mm-hmm. answer, I always think their answers are good. It's that, what AI can do is to take away the tedious tasks that teachers face, can help them be more, I guess what I would say is targeted, because AI obviously can illuminate that a student may or may not be progressing the way that others in the class yeah. are, and they can respond to that. So they have what I think are really reasonable answers to it. But it causes me to ponder, and I think this would be a great topic for, either professional development or even a course, is what does teaching look like if you are able to get rid of that tedious stuff that takes up mm-hmm. so much time? How does the teacher refocus their energy with their students right. in ways that, maximizes relationships or right. really focuses on... I think in education, we've been really diligent on focusing on cognitive learning in our students mm-hmm. because that's what's tested. That's the way that we're evaluated oftentimes by teachers. What happens if we had more time to focus on more affective elements, the will to learn, the motivation right. among our students? I think that's a really fascinating discussion. And I hope that, as we have this dialogue about integrating AI, that becomes a part of that dialogue. Yeah. What could a good future state look like for education? I want to shift gears away from the tech stuff just for a second. I know that what I've observed is that sometimes when, like, my faculty are able to do professional development or training opportunities on passion projects of theirs, mm-hmm. it sort of is igniting this, this fire in them. And I don't like to use words like superstars, but you just sort of see that because they got to elevate that passion, that everything else that they do sort of gets, accentuated in positive ways because of that one spark. Have you seen, indications in interest among the stakeholders that you work with of certain really interesting, perhaps nuanced and niche type requests for professional development like that? Like, I know that one of the things I'm really fascinated with is place-based learning, for example. Mm-hmm. What's the opportunity in the space for teachers to be able to sort of focus on those pet and niche ideas?
So I think through continuing education, we have 330 graduate level continuing education courses, and there are a lot of really interesting ones in there that do allow teachers to explore some pet projects. Mm-hmm. I don't see too many schools going down a path that we're going to teach everybody on this kind of topic that may not be directly related to what are the objectives in our strategic plan. But I like the ability for teachers to kind of explore their own pet passions. And, what we do see are school districts that do make a reasonable investment in continuing education and allow their teachers some flexibility is the turnover rate in those districts is lower. Hmm. And mm-hmm. so those districts, you know, even if it isn't spot on what their strategic plan is, I still think it's making a difference for those teachers, and it's absolutely making a difference for it, maybe a special population within that school that teacher might be learning something about, and is making a difference for that subgroup of students. And so I like the idea, but I also do know that districts need to focus on the big picture items too. Like if kids are not getting through third grade and can't read, they got to read, right? We got to train people on that. I mean, I've seen the stats on it and they're not right at the top of my head, but kids who can't read at third grade are X number of times more likely to drop out of school. They're X times more likely to end up in the criminal justice system. I mean, these are like big life issues that we got to deal with. And so I do think there needs to be a reasonable amount of standardized learning for teachers on core issues around reading, around mathematics, and around teaching writing. And so, but I also like, you know, in terms of just retaining teachers, I think giving them some license, some agency over what their passions are absolutely appropriate.
Yeah, it's always a balancing act, but you're absolutely right. You have to focus on fundamentals and make sure you covered those bases. You have to eat the vegetables before you get to dessert. And
that's right.
Maybe that's a bad analogy for this, but as leaders, we're in those situations to make those decisions a lot. You've kind of touched on this, but I guess I'd like for you to unpack a little bit. Like when you're talking with a district, for example, about some sort of an action plan that they want to partner with you on, what are the things that you talk to them about in terms of saying, here's how we know that our partnership has achieved success? You know, what are the metrics or what are the qualitative outcomes that happens? You mentioned, you know, teacher retention, which is obviously an important aspect for districts. What are some of the things that you look at to know, hey, we just did a really good job?
So, in districts where we are doing continuing education, and that is maybe, you know, five teachers in a school are taking a continuing education course. I mean, we can look collectively at that district that has a high percentage of teachers who are taking CE courses and know certain things about them. What we don't have access to in that case, because that's generally a teacher taking a course with us, we don't have classroom level data in those courses. When we're doing more instructional coaching and kind of deeply embedded with the school, and they might be using our curriculum, they're using our, you know, instructional coaches in math and an ELA, they're doing our summer school program. In that case, especially, we do a lot of work in New York City, is we have annual test data in many of those schools. There's a charter network that we've worked with there very extensively for the last 4 years, and they're in the 97th percentile in the state. And so a lot of it is there around testing. Now, I personally, I believe testing is important. I support it. But there's a much broader measure of success of children. Are they socially, emotionally healthy in the school? Are they progressing in their careers? Are they, you know, making it on to the next level? Mm-hmm. Are they finding their own passions in life? And those things don't necessarily show up in tests. But I believe we are doing well on those metrics, too. But yeah, clearly, you know, the gold standard of is professional development, instructional coaching working? It is, you know, are the students in that school thriving?
Yeah, very good. I think that when I was looking through your website, I noticed that you also, as an organization, provide consultation services with districts. I'm kind of interested, you know, in sort of a last big question. About how you see the relationship between strategic planning and professional development / you know, staff progression of you know, professional growth. You know, that's a cyclical process, but how do you see it playing out in sort of the ideal way where what districts do in partnering with you is tied to a strategic plan that thought about that as it was being built, et cetera?
Right. I'm a huge believer in strategic planning. You know, I've been doing it as a CEO of two different organizations for, you know, 30-some years, and I know there's a correlation between businesses that build strong strategic plans and the success in their outcomes. And I know there's a strong correlation between school districts and superintendents who are doing strong strategic plans. That there is a difference in their outcomes, but it's not just developing the strategic plan; it's actually monitoring it, making sure that all of the district is aligned to that, that you're your high-quality instructional materials are aligned to your strategic plan, that your continuing education, professional development, that your relationship with parents are aligned to your strategic plan, that everyone in the district knows what the strategic plan is and what the imperatives are. And so there is tight correlation between districts that have great strategic plans, adhere to those strategic plans, and their eventual student outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good. Last quick questions, more for fun. So, you know, you think a lot because of your role in the K-12 coalition about, you know, others, you know, progressing their knowledge, progressing their practice. What do you do personally now? You said you got a master's degree later in life, but what do you do as an adult now to continue learning?
I got a bookshelf of books behind me. I read education books. About half of our courses have textbooks assigned to them. I read those. You know, I read the trade journals. I'm interacting with our staff members, our team members, who are really the experts in many of what we are doing. I go to educational conferences and learn from those. I went to the Reading League conference in Chicago last year, and just fascinating things that you're learning about science of reading there. But and then I have my own personal passions outside of work, and I obviously love to do that. But I've gone back twice to get master's degrees, and during my career, and it's one of our core values is lifelong learning in this organization. Yeah. We preach it to teachers, and we believe in it in ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. The biggest problem I have is being intentional about setting aside time for it. And so my strategy is using that time between 6 a.m. and when I leave for work to consume. And then you're right, then you start talking with people once you actually get into the office and that sort of thing. But intentionality is important. Last question, I'm actually going to be in D.C. next week. So presumably you've got a lot of background in helping people navigate the district. What's one thing I should do when I get there?
A personal passion of mine became the Holocaust Museum and instruction on that. I even took one course during my master's degree on teaching about the Holocaust. And so I always felt like that was just something that was super important for children to see when they came to Washington, D.C., was the Holocaust Museum. I've had a personal passion for aviation for my whole life. And so I personally love the Air and Space Museum and the Udvar-Hazy Museum, which is out at Dulles Airport. But those are some of my favorite things to do.
I remember when my family, this would have been probably 10 years ago at least now, we went to the Holocaust Museum, and it was not long after it opened, so it had to have been longer than that. But I remember there was a common reaction when everybody went into the museum and got in the elevator, and everyone, you could just hear people saying, and me thinking it myself, like, wow, this is not constructed to be very pleasant. And then very quickly after you have that impression, you understand exactly why it was constructed perfectly. So agree with you. It's a great learning experience. And one that, if you get to DC is a great thing to do. Hey, I really appreciate you talking with us. I will have the link to the website of the K-12 Coalition, the text accompanying the podcast. I would just point out that this could be relevant not only for district administrators looking for more of a comprehensive approach, but also for individual teachers. And so would certainly encourage the audience to take a look at it and see what opportunities exist. My guest has been Jim Hall. He's the CEO of the K-12 Coalition. Jim, it was great to meet you.
Great meeting you, Scott, and thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
Absolutely. Thank you all for listening or watching the Teaching Matters podcast. If you have comments, thoughts, or suggestions, please feel free to reach out by email at teachingmatterspodcast, all one word, all lowercase, at ohio.edu. We look forward to having you join us again. And I will stop the recording.